Item the first, Europe is getting digitally serious. Item number two, we have picked for you a CEO dream team. And item number three, I cannot believe I'm saying this, but irrational exuberance, anyone? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 6th day of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You will hear in just a bit about the latest political threat to the European Union. That would be tomorrow's election over in the UK. But we are going to start first with the EU trying to get itself digitally unified. This morning, the European Commission announced plans for new rules governing everything from e-commerce to telecommunications over there. Best guesses are that not having a single pan-European digital market is costing the continent and its economies hundreds of billions of dollars at least. Marketplace's Nova Sappho starts us off.
The European Union is supposed to be a single market, but when it comes to the digital economy, its 28 member states have different laws governing everything from telecom to online privacy practices. Chaotic? Sure. And also costly, with the EU losing some $470 billion in economic activity. EU Commissioner Andrus Ansip says Europe is behind the eight ball when it comes to the digital economy.
The internal market is not functioning as it should. We need to change to support jobs and growth.
This is a radical rethink of how the EU does business digitally, says David Fidler. He's a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
This is a big, bold, ambitious project. I mean, the barriers and the fragmentation and the problems and the challenges are very serious and numerous.
And that's hurting Europe's small and medium-sized businesses. They're just not big players in e-commerce. The EU says only 7% of them are doing business outside their country's borders. Even among big companies, the dominant online players are American. Heather Conley is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
And I think it is a natural instinct to go, we need to look at this. We are concerned about the sort of natural monopoly that has happened.
American firms have faced several antitrust investigations, but any new regulatory oversight is years away. The EU still has to finalize its plans and convince member states to go along. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Nova was talking about what this might mean for American companies there. We are going to do a bit more of that with our tech correspondent, Molly Wood. Hey, Molly.
Hi, Kai.
All right. If I am an American tech company, Yahoo, Google, take your pick, any one of them. Am I actually worried about this, or am I just, you know what, we're the best thing out there?
You know, I think that would be their argument. I would imagine that any regulation isn't going to be so strong that it actually damages a U.S. company's ability to do business in Europe. I'd be surprised if they actually went that far, because consumers already know what they can get, and they're going to be pretty mad if they can't get it anymore.
The other side of this coin, or whatever the metaphor is that American tech companies are big investors in European tech. I mean, there are 500 million consumers over there, which is a business opportunity.
Absolutely. And so I can imagine that if it did come down to hardcore regulation, that the American companies would fight back pretty hard. Because it, like you say, it's a big market. They want to be there. They would argue that consumers have already chosen and that they have chosen their services and that Europe can't just sort of try to hold back the tide until it builds up its own digital infrastructure.
The commissioner on the European Commission, who's in charge of this whole thing, said today that they want to prepare Europe to reap the benefits of a digital future. One wonders if they haven't missed the boat and the digital future is here.
Well, that would be the argument of the American companies, which is you didn't get it together, and so you got your hat handed to you a little bit by Amazon and Google and eBay and Uber. And I think that that is a fair argument if you're purely business-minded. But Europe has a history of saying, we want to preserve our way of life, we want to preserve our cultural differences, and we want to slow down the tide until we can build up our own economy, and frankly, that's fair.
You know, it's interesting that that Europe is having such troubles with its digital future, because they have been talking about this idea of a unified European Union for decades now, and it seems that they're just kind of getting to the digital part of this.
It's interesting in the sense that the internet is like water and it goes everywhere. Yeah. And you would have thought that it would spread itself all across Europe, but instead, it's been the American internet companies that did that.
Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Two of the most powerful people in the global economy did a question and answer session at a conference in Washington today. Janet Yellen and Christine Lagarde are their names, the chair of the Federal Reserve and the managing director of the International Monetary Fund. The macroeconomics of their chat in just a second, but there was a very nice after you, no, after you moment as they got going. They were going to take turns asking each other questions, I guess.
Is it for me to ask you a question?
Would you like to Would you like to take a turn?
Yeah. I thought you were going to ask me two, and I would ask you one.
Okay, I thought we could alternate.
Fine.
But
that's
awesome. You.
No, that's fine.
Last time we had Lagarde on the program, by the way, she said she and Yellen try to have a cup of coffee whenever they find themselves in the same city. All right, so now on to the actual economics. Lagarde at one point asked Yellen what the effect of such low interest rates here for such a long period of time has been. And Yellen said, among many other things, this.
I guess I would highlight that equity market valuations at this point generally are quite high.
Equity markets, stocks. Not to get all back to the future on you here, but tell me if that doesn't make you think of this.
But how do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values, which then become subject to unexpected and prolonged contractions?
Those are the worst kind, unexpected and prolonged contractions. Alan Greenspan, almost, if you can believe this, 20 years ago now. Wall Street Today, exuberance was in short supply. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, the politics of the EU as promised. It's basically too close to call in the British election tomorrow. A Labour win would bring about the UK's most left-wing government in decades. A win by the incumbent Conservatives on the right, though, might bring about something else entirely. Prime Minister David Cameron has promised a public referendum on Britain's membership in the European Union, a prospect not overwhelmingly popular with British businesses. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron launched his bid for re-election, pointing at the most photographed door in Britain, the door of No. 10 Downing Street, official London residence of British Prime Ministers for almost three centuries. Cameron said this election would either open or close a new era of prosperity.
The next Prime Minister walking through that door will be me or Ed Miliband. You can choose an economy that grows, or you can choose the economic chaos of Ed Miliband.
Miliband, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, launched his campaign in a similar vein, except he said re-electing Cameron would bring chaos, especially if he holds a referendum on Britain's European Union membership. Miliband urged the voters to back his plan for Britain.
It's a better plan that won't risk jobs, exports and investment by threatening to leave the European Union.
Britain's EU membership does stir strong emotions. This, after all, is an island nation with an imperial past and a long history of repelling continental invaders.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall never surrender.
From Churchill defying Hitler's forces to Margaret Thatcher resisting the very idea that Britain should drop the pound and adopt the euro.
No! No!
Cameron wants to renegotiate the terms of Britain's EU membership, cut some of the red tape strangling British business, claw back some of the powers that Britain has ceded to Brussels, and then ask the British people whether they want to stay in or quit the Union. A random survey of these voters, who do not wish to be named, suggests that Britain could vote to leave.
I don't feel very European, and I don't think many people in England do.
I want us to be a part of Europe. I do not like this British isolation.
I would say now, come out, and I still believe we can go it on our own.
British business is generally friendlier to the EU. Roughly half of British exports go to Europe. Sir Martin Sorrell, boss of the world's biggest ad agency, even questions the wisdom of holding an EU referendum.
Uncertainty is an enemy of taking risk and making investments. And the uncertainty of the referendum, whether it's in 2016 or 2017, at best it's neutral, at worst it's negative.
Sorrell and other pro-Europeans say pulling out would be a disaster. The UK could suddenly face tariffs and other barriers in its largest export market. They say 3 million British jobs could be lost.
I think that's all nonsense, frankly.
But economist Roger Bootle, author of The Trouble with Europe, doubts there'd be any lasting damage at all.
The vast majority of trade that currently takes place between the UK and the rest of the EU would continue to take place.
Britain itself is the single biggest export market for the rest of Europe, so he says they're hardly going to put up tariff barriers against it. And he argues if Britain left the EU, it would be free from what he calls excessive regulation.
If we then deregulated big time and set ourselves up as a lightly regulated economy, then I think it could turn out pretty quickly that Britain was better off out.
Bootle says Britain should focus on the more dynamic markets of the world. Over the last 6 years, the US economy has grown by 8%, China by 70%. The Eurozone has contracted. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
a CEO baseball team has to be motivated, ruthless, and mostly white, guys. Let's play ball.
Batter up. Our CEO dream team straight ahead. But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 0.4% today, 86 points, closed at 17,841. The NASDAQ fell 19 points, also 0.4%, 49.19. The S&P 500 shed 9 points, also, wait for it, yes, 0.4%, finished at 2,080. Zulily started as a website offering flash sales on kids' clothes, and it branched out with deals on lots of things. Now it's losing shoppers because the site is so cluttered. Quote, we have over-assorted the site. That's how the CEO puts it. I love that corporate speak. Zulily in a flash sale, down more than 8% today. Big banks were all off. Morgan Stanley and Citigroup down 1%. Goldman Sachs off about 0.5%. Bond prices fell as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose 2.24%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue consumer credit data for March. Stepping back in time, newly sworn in first president of the U.S., George Washington, attended a ball in his honor on May 7, 1789. And let's look ahead. A three-day Humans to Mars summit wraps up at George Washington University. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a study out today in the New England Journal of Medicine that might turn a very particular slice of healthcare economics right on its head. Conventional wisdom says that hospice care at the end of life will improve the quality of a person's final days and save some money in the process. It's cheaper, the thinking goes, to have a small team of caregivers in a gentler setting than a stay in the intensive care unit might be. In fact, the study says that for patients in nursing homes, hospice care meant nearly $6,800 more in spending per patient. From the help desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more.
Here's the first thing you need to know about hospice care. Between 2000 and 2012, the number of people enrolling doubled. That's great, says Pedro Gonzalo, a healthcare economist at Brown.
Hospice does seem to bring value by decreasing, you know, like ICU utilization and feeding tube insertion.
Gonzalo, who wrote today's report, found in essence that hospice is doing what it's supposed to, which is decrease things like visits to intensive care and hospitalizations. You know, the expensive stuff. But here's the problem. At least for nursing home patients, those savings get gobbled up because people are spending longer and longer in hospice. Gonzalo says that's because more complicated patients are being enrolled, like folks with Alzheimer's, and it's hard to know how much time they have left.
Some person may appear frail, then after a few weeks go by, then they perk up again, and then they seem to be stable for 2-3 more years. It's just not easy to do.
But it's more than complex cases driving these longer hospice stays, which brings me to the second thing you need to know about hospice care. Spending has exploded from $2.9 billion to $15 billion in 2012. And some worry that hospice companies are taking advantage of long-standing payment policies, basically bilking the federal government. Nancy Harrison is with the Office of the Inspector General at Health and Human Services.
We found patterns that show that companies target patients with long lengths of stay and medically uncomplicated conditions who may offer the greatest financial gain.
troubling issues that go along with a troubling trend of increased costs. Regulators in Washington have responded and hope to clamp down on this practice by changing how hospice companies get paid. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The M&A talk the past week or so, that's mergers and acquisitions, has centered around a company called Salesforce. Microsoft has been bandied about as a buyer, Oracle at some point as well. Clearly, only the biggies need apply because Salesforce has a market capitalization, a market value of $47 billion. That, in turn, raises a couple of questions. First of all, why would anybody pay anywhere close to that kind of money for a company that doesn't make a profit, as Salesforce doesn't? Number two, Salesforce, what is it that they do again? Here's Marketplace's Dan Weissman.
Salesforce offers customer relations management, basically a master database with all your contacts, or all your team's contacts, or all the contacts across your whole business, and the progress of every sale and contract. And people who like it, they really like it.
I tell people it's like a cult or religion.
That's Gabe Arnold. He consults with businesses on tech for marketing systems, and he runs a LinkedIn group called Salesforce Power Users with more than 30,000 members.
Salesforce users are extremely loyal.
He thinks a combination of a high price tag and a big learning curve are part of what makes people loyal. Once you've invested the money to buy it and the time to implement it, you're hooked. The company has grown super fast. Revenues have grown at like 35%, even if the company doesn't make a profit. Salesforce has done this by buying smaller companies and integrating itself into more functions. The dream scenario, software like Salesforce ties together sales and marketing, big data. In other words,
at some point in the near future, chief marketing officers will control more of the technology budget than the chief technology officer or the chief information officer.
That's Brian Weiser. He's an analyst with Pivotal Research. He says that's potentially a $1 trillion market for a company like Salesforce. He mentions IBM and Oracle as likely competitors. That's the dream. Andrew Bartels from Forrester Research thinks expanding into marketing puts Salesforce up against established competitors, and he lays out another possible scenario.
That at a certain point in time, Salesforce's revenues will grow more slowly. It simply can't sustain 30% revenue growth as it gets bigger and bigger.
At that point, he says, shareholders will start to want profits. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Salesforce, as you heard earlier, if you were listening closely, which of course we hope you always are, is an underwriter of this program. Ten years ago last month, April 2005 to be precise, two guys, one a journalist and one an economist, published a book with the admittedly odd title of Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. Stephen Levitt from the University of Chicago was the economist, not such a rogue after all. Stephen Dubner was the journalist. The book was, to be understated, a smash hit. We've had our slice of reflected glory from them with our once and future Freakonomics bits, but Dubner and Levitt are out with a new book to mark the decade. It's called When to Rob a Bank. Gentlemen, good to have you back on.
Hey, great to be here, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
I should say right at the outset that this is a culling, right, Dubner, of 8,000 blog posts, right?
That's true. Culling reminds me of ethnic cleansing somehow,
but yeah,
I'm going to use a curation. How's that? It's true. We've had a Freakonomics blog for 10 years now. That's when their first book came out. And over those 10 years, we wrote or hosted more than 8,000 posts. And for years, we resisted collecting them or culling them and putting them in a book. And finally, we gave in. And we thought if we could really find enough that would make a really great book, we would do it. And that's what we've attempted to do.
So Professor Levitt, let me ask you the economist's question here, which is you've been giving this stuff away for years, and now we're going to pay for it?
Yeah, you wouldn't think it would be a great business model.
You know,
but
I'm just saying.
It seems to work for, you know, bottled water. They've been doing that for a whole long time, very profitably,
right,
for $100 billion a year. But in essence, we did add a little bit of value here in that to go and find the good ones out of all the trash we've been producing for the last 10 years is not an easy thing to do. Most of what we've done has been pretty much pure garbage. So I think we did add some value in putting into a book.
Plus, someone would have to sit down and actually read through the blog. the way that we did to put it together. And I promise you, they would pay us way more than the $20 that the book actually cost to not have to do that.
The fun part of this book for me actually was picking through, because you don't have to read it sequentially. I mean, yes, you guys have curated, but you can dip in and out. One of the posts you wrote, Levitt, was about going on The Daily Show and what a good time it was and what a great guy Jon Stewart is and blah, blah, blah. But that he wanted you to explain regression analysis in like 15 seconds live on television. And that gets me to how you guys explain what you do in these short little bits in the blog posting. That's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, so in fact, we don't do that much explaining in the blog post. We tend not to focus much on methodology. There's all the big things you study, really important questions. And then there are the little things that don't add up to an academic paper, that don't add up to a chapter of a book. But for 400 words, you really want to say something about them. And that's what I love about the blog post is the opportunity, both for Dubner and I to speak in our own voices, which is a little different than what we do where we're a unified soul, but also just little things that are almost completely and totally trivial and yet can keep your interest for, you know, 5 minutes at a time.
For all the conversations you and I have had, Dubner, over the years and the ones that we will have in the future as
God
you
willing.
Keep coming back on the show, yeah, I don't think I've ever asked you this question. How has your process changed as you have collaborated so closely with an economist? Do you think now more in economic terms as you write this stuff?
You know, I think so, but it's hard to I think it's a little bit like, you know, when you haven't seen some, you know, little nephews or nieces in your family for like 3 years and they look like giants, right?
Yeah,
but if
yeah.
they're your own kids, you don't even notice that they're growing.
Right.
And I think I've had a growth spurt of some kind over the last 10 years. But it's hard to notice, A, in myself, and B, because it's been gradual. I don't know, Levitt, you're probably the better one to ask that question of.
Yeah, it's a good
have
thought.
Have I gotten even a tiny bit smarter past 10 years?
Oh, you always were smart.
A tiny bit. You've gotten a tiny bit smarter.
I think you've learned a lot about economics, and I think you think more like an economist than you used to. But I don't know. I mean, I think I've probably moved as much towards you as you've moved towards me, although, like you say, it's hard to know in yourself. But I definitely feel more at home with you than I do with my academic colleagues these days.
That's a sad commentary, but I'll take it.
Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt. One's a journalist. One's an actual economist. You guys figure out which one is which. The book is called When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having
us, Guy.
We touch on fantasy sports every now and then. Today, though, something just a little bit different. Instead of drafting his actual favorite players, comedian Greg Proops has put together his ideal business team for us, an all-time CEO dream team, if you will.
Well, spring is here, and the smell of green is in the air. A CEO baseball team has to be motivated, ruthless, and mostly white guys. Let's play ball. First base, Steve Jobs. Super innovative at reaching for other people's ideas. He can cover first base with an eye to stealing second. He'll yell and scream and achieve his dream. Second base, we've cut out austerity measures.
You're out!
At shortstop, Tony Hayward, former CEO of BP. Great at cleaning up big spills. He'll cover loads of ground. He can go into the deep hole and still feel good about himself. In center field, Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs. Blanksy is definitely President Obama's favorite player. When a player gets paid this much, he has to be good, right? Blanksy will dominate. In right field, Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan. Bring him in front of the commissioner and he just laughs. The man who told Senator Warren, "So hit me with a fine, we can afford it," he gets the call to hold down right field. Right field requires the strongest arm, and the Diamond Dog has got the bark and bite, baby.
Strike!
Starting pitcher, Jeff Bezos at Amazon. He's got a drone-like arm. He was once named the world's worst boss. He'll back you off the plate with the high, hard ones. Hell, he'll buy all the scorecards and have his minions fill them in if necessary. Left field, Dick Costolo at Twitter. Let anyone yell whatever they like. The Twit, as we know him, recognizes there's no way to keep fans from raining sexist, racist abuse, and he seems cool with that, just so they keep it under 140 characters. Catcher, Mike Jeffries from Abercrombie & Fitch. This field general will micromanage the game. He knows where everyone should play, what underwear they should wear, and where his dogs sit on the private plane to the next game. Equipment manager, Chip Wilson from Lululemon. No one gains weight on his watch. If you go up a size, Chip will blame your thighs. Motivates the clubhouse with some sassy Ayn Rand quotes like, to say I love you, one must first be able to say the I. Then he puts you in some tight, sheer stirrup pants. Chipper puts the I back in team.
Greg Proops, his new book is called The Smartest Book in the World. We had to cut a couple of positions for time, obviously, but we've got the full roster of Greg's CEO Dream Team at Marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, direct from the Marketplace desk of things that make you say, oh man, I totally knew it. The NFL's investigation into Deflategate came out today, the sad and sorry episode of the New England Patriots and the deflated footballs in the AFC Championship game this past season. Suffice it to say, they did it. An investigator hired by the league says it was, quote, more probable than not that the Pats did indeed deflate the footballs to make them easier to handle in that day's rainy conditions, and also that quarterback Tom Brady was, quoting again, at least generally aware, end quote, of what was going on. The Marketplace parlor game among sports fans here this afternoon has been guessing what punishment the league might hand down. I've heard everything from a $500,000 fine for the team to Brady being given at least a six-game suspension. You can quote me on this one, you guys. Take it to the bank. There is no way Brady gets suspended for six. I don't know. What do you think? Six games? I don't think so. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM.